I'm Christopher Lydon with one of the esteemed talkers in the talkiest big society out there. Pratap Mehta is a one-man think tank based in Delhi. We could talk cricket, the Indian game that England just happened to invent. Or we could talk Maoism and the astonishing array of social conflict in India today. Or the yawning gap between democracy and caste and class inequality in India. Or what we think of India, or India thinks of us. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Or we could ask Pratap Mehta, perhaps the preeminent public intellectual in India, to take us through the reconsiderations of the partition of India and Pakistan back in 1947. You know the continuous outrages from Taliban sanctuaries inside Pakistan and CIA sanctuaries inside Pakistan are just fragments of a pretty well broken U.S.-Pakistan relationship. May well be a bigger story, really, than the war in Afghanistan itself. Yeah. Are you agitated about it?
Yes. I mean, and I think it is the one foreign policy challenge that probably agitates most Indians considerably because it cuts very close to us, not just geographically, but also psychologically. I mean, in some sense, the fate of Pakistan is so intertwined with the history of modern India, with the way we conceptualize our own identities and selves, that it is existentially a very, very important question.
How do you define it? When Indians talk about it, where do they begin?
I think in the Indian view, the fundamental challenge of dealing with Pakistan is that Pakistan has a perpetual identity crisis.
Yes.
It is a state whose identity is largely defined by, as Farzana Sheikh put it, by this other called India. And that so long as that identity persists, it is going to be very difficult for Pakistan to come to terms with the enormous challenges that it faces, as it were, internally. So it is a question at all levels. I mean, a question of terrorism, a question of geopolitics, but fundamentally the question of the identity of a big country.
Pratap Mehta, I'd love you to go back 60-plus years to the partition decisions, which some people would tell you trace the history even to this day.
Right.
And specifically of the question of what it means to be an Islamic state and how the Islamist side of Pakistan got, in many ways, out of hand. In what way do thoughtful Indians like you find themselves rethinking this whole question, including the roles played by Muhammad Ali Jinnah and Mahatma Gandhi, Nehru, the whole cast in that rather sudden end of British India?
I think we're at an interesting historical juncture where there is a lot of rethinking about the history of partition. Up till now, there's a kind of standard narrative, which is, that there were forces working for a united India, namely the Congress Party. Along comes somebody like Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who plays the separatist card, and you get partition, and that's a disaster. I think there was a fundamental challenge to the Indian nationalist movement which it did not have an answer to. And the challenge can be posed in the following terms. And I think it's a challenge you see, for example, even in states like contemporary Iraq or Turkey, in following terms, which is it was very clear that universal suffrage was going to be introduced in India and there was going to be a democracy. Now, in a democracy where you have a majority and a minority, the question arises, how will the minorities' rights be protected? Now, the United States has one model of protecting that, which is you guarantee basic freedoms in a broadly liberal constitution. But that begs the question that that constitution is going to be administered by somebody. And if the majority wields power consistently and is fixed along a religious or ethnic line, the minorities will feel vulnerable. So how do you protect minorities? And that was essentially the question Jinnah was asking, right? Now comes the challenge, which is if you give minorities representation in excess of their population, so you say that, look, there are certain things on which you have a veto power, right? You run the risk of a majoritarian backlash because the majority says, look, one person, one vote. Ideally, it should not matter what your identity is to a democracy, right? But if you're giving minorities special veto powers over certain matters, you are in effect saying that we don't have a project of common citizenship, right? On the other hand, if you don't give minorities enough veto powers, right, they don't feel secure. Now, the truth is that in all the negotiations from 1905 onwards about what should be the shape and form of Muslim representation, right, there never was a stable answer to this particular political dilemma, right? And I think the big lesson is that once the problem of representation was posed as a problem of the relationship between a majority and a minority, right, there was never going to be a stable answer that satisfied both. Right? The only option that India did not have, and I think it's an interesting piece of, I think, intellectual history, which is that the United States took the option of saying, who you are, what your identity is, right, should not matter to what political rights you have. Right? Mm. That was the one position that was actually not available within the Congress's thinking about modern India.
And why not?
I think two reasons. I mean, the first was that it was always assumed that the pull of religious identities in India is so much deeper that any conception of citizenship that fully detaches the idea of citizenship from your religious identity is not going to be a tenable one. The second is that I think Gandhi in particular, and I think this is what the Congress Party took over, had a conception of India which was really a kind of federation of communities.
Yes.
It was not about liberating individuals from the weight of community identities. It was really about friendship between different communities.
Yes.
Right? So Congress Party, at one level, I think its political imagination still saw India as a federation of communities, not as a project of liberating individuals
yes.
from the burden of community identity to be whatever it is that they wish to be, right? So within that framework, it turned out that there was actually no stable solution to this problem of how do different communities be represented in a structure of power that does justice to the anxieties of all. So I think one big rethinking around partition is that it's not just that Jinnah was the villain in the story. It is that the way the political discourse framed the problem to begin with as a problem of the representation of different communities, it was not possible to imagine any outcome that was satisfactory. The other way of thinking about this, which is to think of a conception of citizenship where identities matter less, who you are matters less to what political rights you have, that was never taken seriously as a political project. And perhaps that would have provided at least a much more ideologically coherent way of dealing with the challenges of creating a modern nation state.
If they were doing it again, what emphasis, what rank, what priority would people give to the straightforward Hindu-Muslim difference? In other words, I think Gandhi's notion was that in the community definition of these entities, that religious line was not paramount.
Right.
What is hindsight wisdom on this? Who exaggerated it? How did it come to be the fighting line?
I don't think anybody can deny the fact that religion was terribly important to Indians and still remains terribly important to Indians. I think the mistake that we made was not to see individuals as the bearers of those religious and identity, but rather place greater emphasis on sort of group equality.
Yes.
So the problem of religion and Hindu-Muslim relations is not the problem of how do you get Hindus and Muslims to get along, right? That's a problem that I think arises more as a result of the quest to build a modern nation, where you began to say, who is an Indian, right? How do you benchmark loyalty to India? In the process of that, of asking that question, which all modern nations asked, you generated all kinds of anxieties about who would belong and who would not belong. So I think the fundamental challenge for India was to come up with a conception of Indian national identity that was not benchmarked around a essentialist question, what is India? What does it mean to be Indian? It was a challenge to come up with a conception of rights and democratic participation and citizenship, where you say, look, who you are, where you came from, does not matter to what political rights you will exercise in this new dispensation. Instead, what we did was we said justice requires that what political rights you have be structured around the group identities you have. So Muslims require a certain set of rights, Hindus require certain sets of rights. Once we went down that road, I think it was going to be very difficult to find a stable equilibrium solution.
You're aware that the two big newspaper groups in both countries are working on some kind of dialogue, and they've wondered if we could play a part in the conversations. What are the most important conversations to be had? And I'm assuming it's at the level of ordinary people, not officials or even great opinion makers.
The dialogue between Indians and Pakistanis is marked by this paradox, which is at the level of individuals, it is extraordinarily warm and sentimental.
Yeah.
Even now, I mean, you know, when Pakistanis come over for cricket matches, when Indians visit Lahore, I mean, there's a sort of torrent of nostalgia, sentiment, and, you know, and these dialogues always produce extraordinary music at this Aman Ki Asha sort of initiative. I think it's biggest contribution maybe to the flow of music, actually, than more than anything. So there is an extraordinary sentimentality about it. But I think there is a premise in this dialogue, which is a little bit problematic. And I think this is a premise that actually goes back to pre-partition days, which is one narrative of Hindu-Muslim relations is the following, which is that, you know, there's no enmity between the peoples. Peoples love each other. They share a lot. There's a free flow of culture, ideas. I mean, it is only when you come to politics that politics sort of distorts this sort of spontaneous free flow of cultural exchange. And if we could somehow only get that cultural exchange to its place of primacy, right, we could mitigate the disasters that politics has visited upon us. I think there is something still of that premise operating. So we veer between this kind of real schizophrenia in Indian-Pakistan relations, with at a cultural level, immense nostalgia, immense warmth. But that is quite compatible with a great deal of, as it were, political hostility. And I think the Aman Ki Asha campaign is actually a perfect example of this, because in India, the perception is that while people-to-people dialogue should be encouraged, and certainly this is a remarkable initiative in that direction, the very group that is promoting this, which is the Times Group, which is one of India's largest media groups, also has the reputation of being something like the Fox TV of India. Post-Mumbai, if there was one television channel that was calling probably for the hardline political response, that was literally rousing passions to the point of sort of, you know, I think almost dangerous levels, it was actually the Times News Channel. So it was almost operating in two registers simultaneously, being relentless about India-Pakistan relationship being just about one agenda item, even when India made some conciliatory gestures post-2611, I think the first news channel to kind of jump on criticizing the government for harboring these illusions about the Pakistani state. So there's a real schizophrenia in this campaign about, you know, this sort of strange personal-to-personal chemistry, people-to-people chemistry, this great cultural exchange, yet at the same time fermenting immense political cynicism about the relationship between these two states, and to the point that actually I think it ties the government's hands. I mean, it arouses domestic public opinion in ways that are not very constructive for any political initiative. And I don't mean to say that I think there's a kind of insincerity in sort of, you know, in this cultural politics. I think both groups mean well. But I think there is this sort of odd view that somehow this cultural exchange can overcome the challenges posed by our politics. And that what happens in that political sphere is somehow we can be made much more marginal. And I find that paradoxical because these are newspapers and very much engaged in that political dialogue and that political process as well.
In addition to the sentimentality and the political hostility, we hear also, shall we say, just heartbreak, this sense of the wound of partition that keeps on wounding people. It wounds families, it wounds individual lives in a very grave way, an unforgettable sort of separation. All the more because if we go from our village in India to cousin's village in Pakistan, it's the same place.
That's right.
Same accent, same food, same jokes, same child rearing, the whole thing. And yet it can become extremely difficult, if not impossible, to go to the cousin's wedding or the grandfather's funeral, this kind of thing. Who wants to do something about it?
You know, I think you've put it well. I mean, in a sense, I think partition is not just a kind of political split. It is a kind of internal split inside our psyches, right? So if Sikhs can't go to the birthplace of Guru Nanak, which happens to be in Pakistan, as freely, it is a burden on the psyche. For families that are divided across the borders, it's a burden on the psyche. For regions like Kashmir, which are kind of fissured by this line of control, right? This immensely militarized line of control, right? It's an immense burden. So there is, I think there is a lot of sentiment that we need some fresh thinking about how to undo this. And to be very honest, I think, you know, during the last years of President Musharraf, India and Pakistan seem to have come very close to actually making a real breakthrough in this relationship. I think the contours of the Musharraf-Manmohan Singh settlement, which have actually not been talked about a lot in the United States, were perhaps the most creative and eminently sensible proposals that have come for a long time. Because the premise of those proposals was the following. I mean, the basic architecture which is workable, which is that, look, we are not going to be able to solve our border disputes in one shot. But let us try and make these borders more and more irrelevant. So it talked about promoting cross-border trade. Most importantly, in the case of Jammu and Kashmir, it talked about not just opening movement across the line of control, but actually creating a joint mechanism that would be run by both sides of Kashmir, Pak-administered Kashmir and Indian Kashmir, to actually manage cross-border issues. Mm. It's a small institutional step, but would have been a great innovation in actually creating these flows. And I think the slogan which Prime Minister Manmohan Singh used, President Musharraf used, which is, let's focus more on making borders irrelevant rather than quibbling over them, I think was the right framework and the right approach. And I think it's a pity that, you know, President Musharraf's own domestic authority declined just at the point at which something like a good breakthrough seemed possible. So it's not just that there is sentiment. I mean, I think there are some very concrete and workable proposals on the table. But there is a sense in India that Pakistan's domestic political economy is going to be made it very hard for any government in Pakistan to actually build on these gains. But there are certainly workable proposals on the table.
And what will advance them?
I think the core issue is going to be that the Pakistani military establishment has to decide once and for all that its powerful position in Pakistani society is not premised on or has to be detached from, as it were, its relationship with India. Because one of the reasons I think the Pakistani military has a lot invested in conflict in India is because it is the conflict that allows it to, as it were, have such an overweening presence inside Pakistan. And I think you'll need a visionary Pakistan general to take that leap of faith and say, look, it is in Pakistan's interest, even though it may not be in the military's interest, right, to have better relationships with India. I think that's the core leap the Pakistani military establishment needs to take. I don't think there are that many impediments at the popular level, to be honest. Would something like the Musharraf Manmohan framework be accepted domestically by the populations of both countries? I think the chances are extraordinarily high. But I think the establishment, which particularly inside Pakistan, which has a lot to lose by that, right, has to finally say, we are going to do what's best for Pakistan, not what's best for us.
In your view, Pratap Mehta, what has fueled these extremes of murderous Islamic extremism that killed Taseer, for example, and just scares the wits out of the rest of, out of everybody about the future of Pakistan?
I think much of that process began in the 70s. And one has to understand that the Islamization of Pakistan was not a outgrowth of popular sentiment or pressures from below. It was a very self-conscious, deliberate policy of the Pakistani state. Now, why did the Pakistani state do this? Why did it sort of create this monster which may now come to bite it? A couple of factors were at play. One, and this is not talked about in the U.S. and frankly in India also not as much, although I think it is a decisive factor. The 1971 war with India, which led to the creation of Bangladesh,
yes,
and India's intervention, I think had a much more traumatic effect on Pakistan than I think most Indians realize. I mean, I think the Indian view is, look, we went, we, you know, protected Bangladesh, Bengalis from genocide. It was a case of humanitarian intervention, which happened to dovetail with our national interest as well. Otherwise, we would have been saddled with millions and millions of refugees. And that was it. Right? But I think what 1971 did was exacerbate Pakistan's identity crisis in two respects. One, up till 71, its identity was premised on being the unique homeland for Muslims in the subcontinent, right? The two-nation theory. Suddenly, the creation of Bangladesh complicated that theory, to put it mildly. Mm. It could no longer even claim to represent or be the unique homeland of South Asian Muslims. So that it then had to look for an identity which was not based on Jinnah's version of a kind of Muslim majority state that was broadly liberal, right? But was still a kind of Muslim homeland, if you like, for Muslims of the subcontinent. It moved self-consciously away from that to a much more Islamic identity. And General Zia in particular, right, really encouraged and fomented the Islamization of Pakistani society, Pakistani military establishment. As some, I think M.J. Akbar once put it provocatively, Pakistan decided after 1971 to try and become a West Asian state more than a South Asian state.
Mm. Right? West Asian meaning?
West, you know, its links with the Arab world, Wahhabi Islam, all of that. Which was then aided and supported by the fact, by Pakistan's very close links with Saudi Arabia. One of its biggest financial benefactors. In India, in fact, there's a perception that the Pakistan nuclear program is in part a proxy Saudi nuclear program, right? So you had the immense influence of Saudi Arabia and kind of Wahhabism.
And the United States in the Reagan, and the Reagan years.
Which was then exacerbated by the United States' decision to support the creation of the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets, right? There is another theory going around, I mean, which is compatible with this, which is, I think, important, is that, you know, up till 1971, the Pakistan Army was very much the professional British Army, right? And even during the 1971, post-1971 war, all accounts are that Indian and Pakistani soldiers treated each other as sort of professional adversaries. General Zia saw that as actually a weakness in the Pakistani military because it was actually not driven by any ideological mission. And in fact, many Pakistani generals in 1971 read Pakistan's defeat as evidence of that. So they decided that this is a military that needed to be animated by a much stronger sense of ideological mission than, you know, just another professional army created by the British fighting according to the rules of those armies, right? And so the Islamization of the military actually begins. So it has long, deep historical roots, at least, you know, that go back at least 40 years. But I would say that I think 1971 was perhaps a decisive turning point in that, which was then aided and abetted by U.S. intervention, U.S. aid to the Mujahideen, U.S. encouragement to the Pakistani establishment, and so forth.
Does anybody think of undoing it?
I think there is a lot of thought about undoing it, but as you know, in politics, I think the most effective measures are often the most indirect ones, right? And so what do I mean by indirect measures? I think Pakistan also suffered from one other, I think, challenge compared to India, which is that the structure of power inside Pakistan remained very much in the hands of its kind of old landlords. I mean, for all its limitations as a democracy, India managed to create a very large middle class very rapidly. And I think the churning of power was such that if you ask the question, you know, who governs India? I mean, the Prime Minister of India once jokingly said that India doesn't have an establishment. In Pakistan, primarily the collusion of landed interests and the state in the first instance, compounded by their collusion with the military, created a ruling establishment that seemed to the Pakistani people, I think, a lot more close than the Indian establishment is, right? And so it's much easier to, as it were, delegitimize the Pakistani state, or the Pakistani state has, in a sense, much less, if you like, popular acclaim and roots behind it than I think the Indian state has managed to acquire. So in that vacuum of, you know, genuine churning of power, all kinds of forces stepped in. So the core challenge is how do you get the Pakistani state to be much more open and genuinely responsive to democracy? And my submission to you still is, I mean, I think most Indians feel that about Pakistan, is that for all the Islamization of Pakistan, in open democratic elections, Islamic parties will still remain relatively marginalized. That despite General Zia trying to convert Pakistan into a West Asian style Islamic state rather than a South Asian sort of, you know, rather than drawing on the South Asian traditions of Islam, I mean, you know, ones which Indian Muslims have adapted to democracy wonderfully and well, that cultural weight of it being a South Asian country still remains strong enough to be an antidote to that Islam. But the Pakistani state has to be very clear in its head that it's not going to give aid and succor to anybody who engages in terrorism and violence. And unfortunately, the Pakistani people are now paying the price for it.
Pratap Mehta, there are so many things in your part of the world that fascinate us. You've given us a wonderful introduction to some of them. Maybe we'll come over your way and pursue the rest.
Look forward to it.
This has been extremely interesting to me. Thank you, Pratap Mehta. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.